I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, which this week takes part in the first ever Russian-Arab summit in Moscow, unfolding amidst Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza and Trump's renewed threats to bomb Iran over its nuclear program. All this as Washington escalates its proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, expanding intelligence sharing with Kiev to enable strikes deep into Russian territory while discussing the sale of long-range Tomahawk missiles to the puppet Zelensky junta. Meanwhile, another U.S. regime change war appears to be on the horizon after Trump called off diplomatic efforts with Venezuela following a string of deadly American strikes on boats off the country's coast and a buildup of U.S. forces around the nation with the world's largest proven oil reserves. Joining me is a former advisor to the U.S.-Russian Bilateral Presidential Commission at the U.S. State Department under President Obama. He's now editor of the Realist Review. James Carden joins me from Washington, D.C. James, thanks so much for coming on. So Trump, self-declared anti-war president, he's been killing Venezuelans, bombing Yemen, Iran. Now he's considering selling Tomahawk missiles to Zelensky. What are we to make of how close Trump is going to get us into a hot war with Russia?
Well, the thing about Donald Trump is no one really ever knows what Donald Trump is going to do, perhaps not even Donald Trump himself. No one has any right to be surprised about the turn that his foreign policy has taken over the past 10 months or so. If you appoint neoconservatives to the most important national security positions in your government, you are going to get a neoconservative policy. And that's exactly what we have.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about those cabinet positions on this show as in the run-up to them being made. Just remind us, not only that Rubio is Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, but that John Ratcliffe is the head of the CIA, and they're expanding intelligence sharing with Zelensky to target Russia, presumably against the spirit of the Alaska summit meeting. These characters, Ratcliffe and Rubio.
Ratcliffe and Rubio, and then Rubio, of course, is dual-hatted as national security advisor. So he's the first high government official to hold both positions simultaneously since Henry Kissinger. The one thing we know about Marco Rubio is that he's no Henry Kissinger, whatever one thinks of Kissinger. The other problem that has reemerged is Jared Kushner. So recent reports have shown that Trump has decided to rope in his longtime friend, Steve Witkoff, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to deal with the negotiations with regard to Israel-Gaza. And the reemergence of Kushner is another thing to be worried about. So Mr. Trump, for all of his campaign rhetoric and for all of his promises that he was going to pursue an America First foreign policy, has basically made the same mistake that he made in his first term. He surrounded himself with people who have loyalties to Israel and who are longtime neoconservative activists in Congress, like Rubio.
And we know, because of Candace Owens' work, that the base, the MAGA base that got Trump elected to a great degree, do not share the Zionism of Kushner or the pro-Israel ideas of Larry Ellison and Rubio and the rest of them. And of course, that's causing the controversy over the Charlie Kirk assassination. Do you think Trump is just figuring it out that we could just buy up the media, we can get Larry Ellison to take TikTok to stop those images coming from Gaza of the slaughtered children, and also with this power of the media, they'll somehow start supporting Trump as well? Is that the strategy, away from the geopolitical war strategic aims of any normal Washington administration?
I think it's always been very open to question how much Donald Trump actually cares about the people who have put him into office. I think people have made certain analysts, pundits, journalists have made the mistake of thinking that Trump heralds a kind of new chapter in the Republican Party with regard to foreign policy. And it is true that there are some dissenters from the mainstream pro-Zionist line, like Owens, like Tucker, like Marjorie Taylor Greene. But the fact of the matter is that it's all really window dressing. The Republican Party Donald Trump has not changed the Republican Party's foreign policy. He talks a good game, but the fact of the matter is that the Republican foreign policy establishment is unchanged. And the Republican foreign policy establishment is firmly in control of Donald Trump's foreign policy. So what you have is a shocking continuity from what we've had over the past 25 years, from Bush to Obama, Obama to Trump to Biden to Trump. It's all the same stuff. Donald Trump and his base have not changed or been able to challenge the Washington Uniparty, the Washington War Party. And that is a fact. And that's what we're seeing now play out.
And he feels fine about Steve Bannon and those other elements of the MAGA movement opposing him on all of this, on making Israel great again rather than on making America great again and all these other issues in regards to foreign policy?
The thing that I've heard from people who have worked with Trump and who know Trump all say the same thing, is that Donald Trump has the skin of a rhinoceros. In other words, you can disagree with Donald Trump, you can criticize Donald Trump, you can do so in the most brutal sort of language. It doesn't bother him at all. For him, this is kind of professional wrestling. You know, you have to remember that he came from that world. He came from the world of New York real estate, but also of entertainment. And also he was very tied in with these professional entertainers who are over the top. And, you know, his ties to the professional wrestling world are very deep. He made the ex-wife of the founder of the world's most, you know, lucrative wrestling entertainment business, his secretary of education. So, you know, Trump, it doesn't compute. And really what, for him, it's all about perception and it's all about deals. And that's it. And so the idea that he was going to somehow come in and change the trajectory of the U.S. foreign policy establishment is mistaken. And, you know, I'm sure people can go back and look at things that I've written over the past few years and point to me and say, you fell for it too. I did. I wanted to believe.
It's only been a few months, in fairness. I mean, added to all of this, of course, is Trump. I mean, he does get that daily briefing, supposedly, from Tulsi Gabbard. And in the news, if you should believe the news, there are casualty figures in the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine that are being bandied about as if they're truthful. What's your take? I mean, you were there in the State Department. You're the expert on, you know, Russia relations with the U.S. When you see the kind... I mean, this is the Sulzberger New York Times the other day. I can hardly pronounce her name. It might be a kind of Ukrainian first name. Yulia Sviridenko's debut trip to the United States as Ukraine's prime minister began at a showcase of American capitalism. I'm not even sure who this woman is particularly, and who Zelensky's cabinet is, because, of course, as we know, the Zelensky regime is one that's incredibly opaque and presumably run from Washington anyway. Why are all the media lying about casualty figures in Ukraine, for instance, let alone what's going on?
Well, I mean, the first reason is that's what countries do when they're at war. Those are the most closely held state secrets during the course of a war. What you don't expect or shouldn't expect is that, you know, papers like the Times and the Post and the Guardian and whoever repeat these figures as fact. Of course, they're not fact. They bear no more resemblance to the casualty figures that the United States was releasing during the Vietnam War. The actual figures, from what I've heard from a very trusted source who spends part of the year in Ukraine, is that when the Russians and the Ukrainians agree to exchange their dead, right, the ratio is 36-1. So for every one dead Russian soldier the Ukrainians hand over, the Russians hand back 36 dead Ukrainians. Well, that's an extraordinary ratio. And it points up to the fact that the numbers that we're getting from the New York Times and the Pentagon are bald-faced lies.
And you had a good deal of respect for Tulsi Gabbard, seeing through the Syria dirty war, overthrowing Assad, which arguably enabled the genocide in Gaza later on. She's there, Director of National Intelligence, and yet we see Trump every other week repeating the casualty figure numbers, continually saying, oh, Russia's losing so many, and therefore that's helping him determine strategy, perhaps the Tomahawk missiles.
Well, that's right. But again, this confirms what I was saying to you earlier. The blob wins. The establishment wins. Tulsi Gabbard is at the head of an organization, the Directorate of National Intelligence, that was stood up after 9/11 and actually doesn't have all that much power. It's a coordinating agency. If Donald Trump knew what he was doing, he would have appointed her head of the CIA, where the actual power is. Now, she's tried to take over she's taken over the president's daily brief and all that. But, you know, if you're not getting reliable information into the brief, then what's the point? So, you know, Gabbard had an admirably, I think, brave career in Congress. But, you know, it's mission impossible for Tulsi Gabbard because she's basically the only person in the administration, perhaps with the exception of J.D. Vance, who as vice president doesn't all have all that much power either, who is a America First foreign policy advocate. So, you know, she's in a tough position, but I've always written sympathetically about her because she was one of the few Democrats who actually still cared about matters of war and peace.
James Garden, I'll stop you there. More from the former advisor to the U.S.-Russia Bilateral Presidential Commission of the U.S. State Department after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the editor of The Realist Review, James Garden. James, you were talking about how few are the number in Trump's cabinet that care about war and peace, although Trump always says he sees the numbers of casualties and it moves him in the proxy war on Russia, and it wouldn't have started without him. Is one problem here the responses we're getting from Russia in terms of stopping the war? Every escalation that NATO countries create, Russia just seems to shrug its shoulders and continues the war of attrition, even to the level of Tomahawk missiles. I mean, one can't imagine when you were in the State Department ever deploying Tomahawk missiles to the borders of Russia and thinking you weren't going to get a response, whereas Putin did say it would destroy relations, and then it seems to be sort of retreating slightly from it. Not even that much about complete confiscation of huge numbers of Russian assets, the Russian people's assets. Not that much of a response from Russia on that too, which allows NATO powers and the EU vassal states to just talk at will about how they can defeat and break up the Russian Federation.
Well, you said two very important things there, attrition and vassal states, and I'll get back to that in a second. I do want to make it very clear that any sort of decisions about deploying missiles or what have you would have been about a million steps above my pay grade there, so I don't want to mislead you.
I didn't think you actually placed them.
War game,
the response for deployment in Havana.
But, you know, you said war of attrition. That's exactly what it is. And people don't, or the media here doesn't really seem to understand that. So when people talk about the war, they'll say Russia's losing. And when you ask them why, they'll say, well, they haven't retaken, you know, as much of Ukraine as they set out to do. What they don't understand is that what the Russians are doing now is that they're trying to kill as many Ukrainians as they possibly can before they move into the country. So the point of the war for the Russians is to make it a war of attrition because they're winning that war. The other thing that's important that you said was the reference to vassal states. I think that explains in large part Russia's reaction and disdain, or kind of like, you know, its tendency to ignore the kind of various threats that come their way from the United States and the Europeans, because they know full well that the Europeans are all talk. They're not going to act. They can't act. That they are paper tigers. And they know full well that whatever Donald Trump says about tomahawks and whatever, they know that Donald Trump doesn't want a full-scale war with the Russians. And they've been through this before. During Trump's first term, he, unlike Obama, did send Javelin anti-tank missiles, didn't change the equation. So I think from the Russian standpoint, they're quite right to basically studiously ignore a lot of the noise coming out of Washington and Brussels. For after all, they are winning.
Yeah, you used the paper tiger phrase. That was the insulting phrase Trump used. I don't know whether he realized, from Mao, isn't it, about nuclear weapons. Mao said nuclear weapons was a paper tiger. I don't know whether Trump knew that. And that's why he was using that phrase advisedly from someone. But it is a fact that tying up Russia in that war of attrition, does it allow the United States to go the way Rubio has always wanted to his political career and hit Latin America, Venezuela, and at the same time get Netanyahu to attack Iran as Iran? I mean, if you're saying that the permanent state has never left power. So tying Russia up in this way allows that permanent state to attack both Venezuela at that end and Iran on the other end, while Africa is simmering at the moment, I suppose. They haven't gone big into Africa.
Yeah, and that strategy of tying up Russia has worked because the other goal that they've recently achieved and that they wanted to achieve for the past 15 years or so was the overthrow of the secular, multi-confessional, sovereign government of Syria. So they've seen that that works. And of course, they will never abandon their dreams of overthrowing the mullahs in Iran. They're never going to abandon their dreams of a greater Israel. And of course, with Rubio not only in the mix, but holding the two most important, arguably the two most important national security jobs in the United States government, he brings with him all that Cuban exile baggage. And of course, that means turning the Caribbean and Latin and South America into a war zone. So what we have teed up now are war after war after war. I would find it very hard to believe that Trump's base voted for such a thing. But again, he's a lame duck. He doesn't care. And certainly his team does not care what the MAGA base wants in terms of foreign policy. So they're going to let Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson chirp away and nip at their heels, but it's not going to change a thing, unfortunately.
Depending on how much he wants that peace prize, obviously, I mean, you were at the state, you were at the presidential commission there. I mean, you would not have seen evidence clearly of false flags, although you were there, what, around the time of the Libya operation, 2 years before the 2014 coup. I mean, should we fear that the people around Trump are organizing false flags, Zaporizhia, from Zaporizhia to who knows what, from Venezuela in the Caribbean to, they've repeatedly done it vis-a-vis Iran, to try and put on the desk of the Oval Office in front of Trump, now is the time to act. It's regime change time.
That's entirely possible.
You never saw any evidence yourself of it when you were there, though?
No, of course. No, not at all. Which isn't to say that it wasn't happening, particularly in Syria. But again, you have to have a real job to know to be in the know, and I didn't. So, you know, the issue here is that with regard to Ukraine, of course, the United States funds it. We provide the intelligence, we provide the targeting, but we also have a very enthusiastic partner in the dark arts in the British. And so the British SAS has been maybe the main mover of a lot of the subterfuge that we've seen in Ukraine, particularly with the attacks in Crimea and the bridge. So, I think that we can expect more of the same across the world, in Venezuela, in Iran, and of course, in Ukraine.
And yet we've not seen any attacks from Russia on Britain, it has to be said. Meanwhile, this is all going on against the backdrop of incredibly unpopular elite classes in the vassal states of Western Europe. Their economies lie in ruins, and an amazing amount of small arms and weaponry, billions of dollars worth, being sent to a corrupt government in Ukraine. How dangerous do you think Berlin, Paris, London, Brussels, how dangerous is it even going to be to go on holiday to one of these places soon enough? As the economies clearly suffer, there's civil strife on the streets and just unlimited weaponry.
Yeah, I think the weaponry point is well taken. What we're in the process of doing in Ukraine by pouring in billions and billions of dollars worth of arms into that country that doesn't really any longer have a serious governance structure is what we're doing is creating a supersized version of Kosovo. And so what we've done is turned Europe's largest country by landmass, with the exception of Russia, into a black market. An arms bazaar, and it's going to pose for generations very, very serious security challenges for the rest of Europe. The other thing that, since you bring up Europe, that the elites in Europe are now facing are rest of populations who are unhappy about all this money going to this futile war on behalf of a country that is not part of the EU, that is not part of NATO. In response, what you're seeing are the increasing popularity of the right-wing parties, kind of Europe's own kind of MAGA parties, who are gaining popularity across the board. So that's the next, I think, shoe to drop in Europe.
Not long before it does, with these elections. We're just running out of time, okay. James. I know you're writing a book, and you're going to have to come on when the book is out about important seismic shifts in U.S. history that affect all the lives of everyone on the planet. But I just got to ask you, just finally, these billions of dollars of AIPAC, Zionist money, and all the rest of it, they failed to persuade the American public of the merits of genocide in Gaza. Isn't that show something about the limits to the power of media control and propaganda that would support the Truman Doctrine that I know you're writing about. I mean, has it surprised you that the American public is just not on board with this genocide? They've managed to see through the entire media class of your country?
I wish I was as optimistic as you about that. I think that there are parts of the public, and certainly there are parts of American public opinion that are disgusted by our subservience to Israel and disgusted by the genocide. What all the money buys is the media. And until there's a kind of break in the media, it's going to be very difficult to tell the truth about, you know, our relationship with Israel and Israel's actual history. And you can see now that there's a doubling down on that because they know how important it is to keep control of the main media organizations. Therefore, we have this ridiculous development where Barry Weiss has become the president of CBS News. It's absurd on its face, but she's a good Zionist, and so she's going to be handed the reins of this, you know, multi-million dollar media empire. So it's going to be a very, very uphill battle for public opinion in the United States.
James Cotton, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide in Palestine. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.